Hey everyone, it's Julie Coley with History and Murders in Wichita Falls. So, this has been another one of those weeks. There was somebody last week who, an actual ex-Marine, who threatened to tear down the Civil War monument at Memorial Auditorium. So, last Saturday, a group of us went down there and just stood around to guard the memorial. And it's still there. It's, don't know if they drove by or not. There were quite a few people that drove by. There was one that pulled in, saw what we were doing, saw the guy with the cowboy hat, and they pulled out. So, I guess they thought they were going to do it, and they all chickened out to go up there and do it. So, my podcast last week was about our veterans in the Civil War, the men who thought they were fighting for our country, who are veterans of a war. And it only got about 50 views, which is about a fourth of what my podcasts usually do. So I don't expect too much more on this upcoming podcast because it's about police officers. This week's podcast is about two officers, two different stories, who died in the line of duty. So, let's get started. My first story is about Ollie F. Sammy Childress. The Eighth Amendment to the United States Constitution states that cruel and unusual punishment shall not be inflicted. It is considered unacceptable due to the suffering, pain, or humiliation it inflicts on the person subjected to it. In June of 2002, a case in Virginia set a precedent in regards to this amendment, applying it to the mentally retarded. In Daryl Renard Atkins versus Virginia, it was determined that a law which allowed for the execution of mentally retarded individuals violated the Eighth Amendment. This case set the pace for the stay of execution on the death conviction of Pedro Salas Sosa. In the murder of Wilson County Deputy Sheriff Sammy Childress Jr. in Atascosa County, Texas in 1983. By 2013, Sosa was still sitting on death row, 30 years after he killed Childress, due to a stay of execution in 2006 because of the question of whether his supposed mental retardation violated the Eighth Amendment. After reading this story, you can come to your own conclusion whether or not you think he was mentally sound or mentally retarded. On the morning of November 4th, 1983, Deputy Sheriff Sammy Childress was driving down a rural road in Wilson County, Texas. He was off duty. Pedro Sosa and his 17-year-old nephew, Leroy Sosa, had driven into the county from San Antonio in Pedro's Ford Thunderbird. They decided they were going to rob the Lavernia State Bank and make a quick getaway. As they were driving, they passed Deputy Childress, and they started to hatch a plan. Pedro Sosa decided that they would use the deputy's car to rob the bank. They then turned around in the road and went back to catch up with the deputy. They flashed their lights at the deputy, and he pulled over to the side of the road to see if he could help them. The Sosas pulled up beside the deputy's car, and Pedro got out, pointed a gun at the deputy, and made him scoot over to the passenger seat of his patrol car. Pedro drove the deputy's car, and Leroy followed them in Pedro's to an isolated area off of the main road. Pedro Sosa took the deputy's gun and pointed it at him. He told him to take his clothes off. Deputy Childress complied. Sosa forced him to put his own handcuffs on. Pedro put on the deputy's shirt and forced the deputy to get in the trunk of his patrol car. with brown paper sacks, a ski mask, and a Halloween mask in hand. Both Pedro and Leroy Sosa got into the deputy's car and drove into Lavernia with the intent of robbing the bank. According to Pedro's confession and Leroy's later statement, Pedro put on the ski mask and Leroy put on the Halloween mask, and they both entered the Lavernia State Bank. Pedro Sosa went into an office in the bank and brought out the bank vice president at gunpoint. He announced loudly into the bank lobby that he was holding up the bank, and if everyone would remain calm, no one would get hurt. He also told everyone that he had a deputy in the trunk of the patrol car, and pointing to the deputy's shirt he was wearing, he said that he was the sheriff now. While Pedro was handling the people in the bank, Leroy took the paper sacks to the teller and told her to put all the money in them. After the teller put approximately $52,000 into a paper sack and handed it back to Leroy, Pedro told everyone not to call the police for at least 20 minutes, or he would shoot and kill the deputy in the trunk of the car. The two walked out of the bank, and Leroy got into the deputy's car. Pedro stayed near the entrance of the bank for a few minutes. He went back into the bank and told them that he was watching them and reminded everyone if they called the police, he would shoot the deputy through the back seat of the car. They both got into the deputy's car and drove back to the isolated place on Steinbin Road where they had left their own car. When they got back to their car, Pedro Sosa wiped down the deputy's car to try to clean all the fingerprints off of it. He walked back to the rear of the car, opened the trunk, and shot Sammy Childress in his neck with his own .44 caliber pistol. He closed the trunk of the car, got back in his own car, and he and Leroy left. A few miles down the road, Pedro suddenly realized that he had forgotten to wipe his own fingerprints off of the trunk. So they turned around and drove back to the deputy's car, where he opened the trunk and shot Childress a second time. He told Leroy that the deputy had seen their faces and he wanted to be sure he couldn't identify them. He then wiped down the trunk and the two men drove back to San Antonio. A Crime Stoppers tip was received in December, implicating Leroy Sosa in Sammy Childress's murder. And he was arrested on December 19, 1983. A fingerprint found on a paper sack that was left behind at the bank matched the prints of Leroy Sosa. Pedro Sosa, however, avoided getting arrested by living outdoors and at other places. But on February 4, 1984, he was finally caught and taken into custody as he was driving down the street with his wife in the car with him. Pedro Sosa made a full confession. Before he signed the final confession, he made a few corrections to his statement. Leroy Sosa decided to cooperate fully and implicate his uncle. Witnesses at the bank stated that Pedro Sosa was the one who was clearly in charge of the whole robbery. Pedro Sosa was tried, and a jury found him guilty of capital murder and the death of Sammy Childress on November 27, 1984. He was sentenced to death. He received a stay of execution in 1987, 1993, and 1997. He also received stays of execution due to appeals on October 21st, 1999, October 25th, 2005, and April 25th, 2006. His attorney filed appeals in 2006 and once again April 25th, 2012, arguing that Salas is mentally retarded because his IQ is below a 70. And he used the Atkins case as a defense that I spoke about in the beginning. In a statement online written by Pedro Sosa himself, he says that he was set up, threatened by the agents, saying that they would kill his wife if she tried to escape during his capture while she was with him in the car, and they would put his children in foster care. He further states that his signature on documents were forged, And in his own words, he said that he needs funds to hire investigators, record alteration examiner, and handwriting expert examiner for 3 counts of forgery in record. He goes on to say, I, Pedro Sosa, have no family or true friends who care to help financially or do anything, besides my 87-year-old precious mother and a very poor and divorced and uneducated sister who helps, limited with what she can do. I also have a mentally retarded young brother who helps me monthly with $25 of his mental retarded check. So please send donations to me. He doesn't believe in his mental retardation appeal, stating that I was stopped by my attorneys from defending myself at actual innocence hearing of April 15th, 2008. I have plenty of unquestionable Brady material evidence to prove my innocence, but attorney's only interest is to prove me mentally retarded. Leroy Victor Sosa was sentenced to capital murder and kidnapping on December 19th, 1983, as part of a plea bargain for testifying against his uncle. He is currently serving a life sentence for the murder and 20 years for the kidnapping. As of November 8, 2013, Pedro Sosa is still sitting on death row 30 years after he killed Deputy Sammy Childress in Atascosa County, Texas. The fight still continues to prove that he is mentally retarded and cannot be executed for the brutal murder of the deputy. How much longer will he have to wait to find out what his destiny will be? Several close relatives of Sammy Childress have already passed on. How much longer will his family have to wait to finally get closure? Ollie F. Sammy Childress Jr. was a cowboy hat-wearing kind of sheriff. He was born October 25th, 1929, and died November 4th, 1983. He was the son of Ollie F. Childress Sr. and Annie Bell Tisley. He is buried in the Steel Branch Cemetery in Stockdale, Wilson County, Texas. The Wilson County Sheriff's Department retired his badge number on November 4, 2013. On a monument that sits outside of the Wilson County Sheriff's Office in Floresville, in memory of Sammy Childress Jr., there's a quotation from John Wayne. Courage is being scared to death, but saddling up anyway. Update on this story. I wrote this story, obviously, years ago. So, 34 years after the death of Sammy Childress, his death sentence was commuted to life in prison, and he will, at some point, be eligible for parole. My next story is about Officer Ralph Allen Oblinato. He was a brilliant student in high school. He skipped his junior year and he graduated in 1967 at the age of 16. He was a valedictorian and voted most likely to succeed in his small town of Campbell, in Texas, in Hunt County. One of his classmates said that he was the class nerd, and he walked around with a smile on his face all the time. David Lee Powell was accepted to the University of Texas into their Plan 2 honors program with the highest entrance score they had ever seen. He was majoring in math and physics and aspired to be a doctor. He had a little trouble fitting in at first, partly due to his young age, but he settled in and his grades improved. Things began to change in his sophomore year. He became interested in the anti-war movement and began experimenting with drugs, flower power, peace movements, and the drug scene became part of his life, as it did for so many others in the late 1960s. He dropped out of UT in 1970, and over the next 8 years, he slipped deeper and deeper into drugs. His drug of choice was methamphetamine. Pal's uncle Clem Struve said that he called him one time and during the conversation told him he had to be careful of what he said because the CIA was trying to find him. His family became deeply concerned about his behavior. His mother, Marjorie Powell, had called psychiatrists and different people to try to get help for her son. During this time, he disappeared. They searched all over for him but couldn't find him. Communication between Powell and his family stopped. On the evening of March 17, 1978, David Powell asked Sheila Meinert, who was 27 years old at the time, to drive him from Austin to Killeen to do a drug deal. In her car, he had with him a loaded 45 pistol, a fully automatic AK-47, a hand grenade, and a backpack, which contained 2.25 ounces of methamphetamine worth $5,000. Austin Police Officer Ralph Oblinato was patrolling the streets on his beat, and around 12:30 a.m. he saw a Mustang that didn't have a license plate. He pulled the car over in the 900 block of East Live Oak and Travis Heights Boulevard. Sheila Monarch got out of her car and walked back to talk to the officer. It's something y'all don't do today, huh? She didn't have her driver's license with her, telling the officer that she had lost it, but she showed him her passport as proof of identification. Albinato attempted to run warrants on both Sheila and the passenger, David Powell, but the dispatcher informed him that the computer was down, so he issued Sheila a ticket for no license plate and let them go on their way. As Meinert was pulling away, the dispatcher informed Oblinato that the computers had come back up and she found a warrant for David Powell for misdemeanor theft and for passing over 100 hot checks. Oblinato turned on his lights and pulled the Mustang over again. Sheila once again got out of her car and walked back to talk to the officer. Sheila Meinert heard a loud bang and screamed as she ran back to her car. Later, she claimed that the loud bang scared her, and the only thing she could think of to do was to run. David Powell had shot at Officer Albinato through the rear window of the car. He fell to the ground and got back up, and then Powell shot at him again using the automatic feature on the AK-47. Bam, 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 bam. A total of 10 shots hit the officer. Even though he was wearing a bulletproof vest, the vest wasn't designed to protect against the velocity of a bullet from an automatic weapon. He was able to give a description of the car to dispatch before he lost consciousness. Witnesses stated that it sounded like a machine gun being fired. When it was determined that Powell had outstanding warrants, she dispatched his partner, Bruce Mills, to back him up at the location. When he arrived, he found Ralph laying on the ground. Mills and other witnesses did everything they could to help him while they were waiting for the ambulance to arrive. Ralph Oblinato died on the operating table about an hour after he was shot. Sheila Meinert jumped back in her car and took off with David Powell by her side. She turned a corner and drove into an apartment complex. After hearing the officer shot call on the radio, another officer, Joe Viegas, heard Albinato give a description of the car over the radio. He saw the Mustang in the parking lot of the apartments. As he pulled into the parking lot, he could hear gunshots from an automatic weapon. A shootout and a standoff began, and even though Powell had fired off numerous shots, no officer or patrol cars were hit. Officer Bruce Boardman saw a person on the passenger side of the car throw something over the top of the Mustang. It was later determined that it was a hand grenade. Thankfully, Powell didn't remove the safety clip, also known as a jungle clip, and it didn't detonate. For someone who had never been in the military, Powell probably wouldn't have known that. Not only did you have to pull the pin on a hand grenade, but you also had to pull the safety clip that clamped over the grenade. Many officers' lives were saved that day because of Powell's ignorance, but his intention was still to kill anyone in his path. Sheila Monarch ran away from the car at the time that Powell threw the hand grenade. She was caught and arrested in the parking lot of the apartments. Powell took off running and was arrested about 4 a.m. that morning, hiding in some bushes at the nearby school. The worst feeling in the world that a spouse ever has to feel is a knock at her door in the early morning hours, only to find a fellow police officer on the other side of that door. Instantly, Judy Ablanato knew that something bad had happened. When she arrived at the hospital, Police Chief Frank Dyson and the doctor came out. The doctor didn't have to say a word. The look on his face told the story. Ralph Ablanato had died. Sheila Monarch was given a plea bargain for testifying against David Powell. She served 4 years of a 15-year sentence. She left the state when she got out of prison. On September 11, 1978, David Powell was sentenced to death for the capital murder of Ralph Ablanato. Shortly after his conviction, Powell went on a hunger strike and refused to eat anything for about 13 days. With concern for his welfare, he was sent to Rusk State Hospital for the criminally insane for several months. He was then returned to death row. Powell went through three trials, two regular trials and one sentencing trial. His staunch supporters said that he was an exemplary inmate, and among other things, he taught inmates to read and write. He helped to create programs of literacy and art history for fellow inmates. He was involved in grief counseling to families of murder victims, and he was the recipient of the Brothers Keeper Award by Capacity for Justice, a nonprofit group that advocated for prisoners with disabilities. Even several prison guards said that he was quiet and respectful, not a troublemaker at all. On December 31st, 2009, David Powell wrote a letter of apology to the family of Ralph Ablanato. In that letter, he addressed his children and said, "I stole from you a hero, your natural father. You should not have been limited to learning about him from scrapbooks and family memories. He should have been a vital presence in your life all these years. He would have played with you as children, instructed you, and guided you by his example into adulthood. He would have worried over your sickness and setbacks, exulted in your triumphs. He should have been available to advise and assist you even now. But I took that strength from you." He goes on to say, "The senseless death of Ralph Ablanato has weighed heavily on my soul always. For 5 years, I lived variations of the events of that night, every night as nightmares. Every night, I jolted awake in panic, gasping for breath, heart pounding wildly, from a bunk drenched in sweat. When I killed Officer Ablanato, I killed some part of myself. I have known no peace since." He concludes his letter with, "I wish only to advise you my most sincere apology. I am truly, deeply, and forever sorry for the evil that I have done, for the worlds of suffering I brought you when I killed your loved one, Ralph Ablanato." No matter how many supporters he had throughout the years, a bad decision that David Powell made in 1978 could not be reversed. Regardless of what kind of a person that he had become in prison, he still made the ultimate decision in 1978 to kill a man. If he had only been sentenced to life in prison, as his friends and supporters were fighting for, he would have been released in 1998. The family and friends of Ralph Ablanato could never have accepted that sentence. The execution of David Lee Powell was set for June 15, 2010. As he prepared for his final day, he ate his last meal that consisted of 4 eggs, 4 chicken drumsticks, salsa, 4 jalapeno peppers, lettuce, tortillas, hash browns, garlic bread, 2 pork chops, white and yellow grated cheese, sliced onions and tomatoes, a pitcher of milk, and a vanilla shake. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals and the U.S. Supreme Court denied a last-minute stay of execution. As he prepared to make the long walk to the death chamber, a group of family supporters gathered outside. Only the family is allowed to witness the actual execution. A group of friends and fellow officers caravanned to Huntsville in chartered buses and on motorcycles. Two motorcycle groups, the Blue Knights, which is a nationwide law enforcement motorcycle club, and Los Pistoleros, a motorcycle club of Austin that had many members who are retired police officers, were among those who came to honor their fallen brother. Many of the people in the group wore t-shirts that simply said, "Journey for Justice." They lined the path for the retired officers, current officers, and the Austin PD Honor Guard to show their respect to the family when they arrived to witness the execution. As David Powell was put into the chair and the needle was put in his arm, he declined to make a final statement. During the whole procedure, he fixated his eyes on the Oblinato family, who was watching the murderer of their son, father, and brother die. The official time of death for David Lee Powell was 6:19 p.m. He was on death row for 32 years, the longest-serving inmate ever on Texas death row. Ralph Allen Oblinato was born April 27, 1952, and he died in the line of duty on May 8, 1978. He was the son of Armand and Betsy Oblinato. He was married to Judy B. Hawkins and had two sons. He was buried in the Cook Walden Capitol Parks Cemetery and Mausoleum in Austin. After Ralph passed away, Judy married Ralph's best friend and fellow officer, Bruce Mills, who adopted her two sons and gave them his last name. Well, that's it for the podcast for this week, y'all. Next week, I don't know what I'm going to be doing yet. It's going to probably be a murder story. I'll figure it out between now and then, and we'll talk to you then. Bye-bye. I have written 8 books about Wichita Falls and North Texas. I have 4 in a series called How Did They Die? Murdered in Northern Texas. One is from 1892 to 1926. One is 26 to 74. One is 54 to 2011. And then I have Murdered in the Line of Duty. So it's about officers around Texas who have been killed in the line of duty. I've also written 4 picture books. One is called Views of the Past, Downtown Wichita Falls. One is Views of the Past, Downtown Wichita Falls, Volume 2. One is Views of the Past, Wichita County, Texas. And the last one is called Way Back When, a picture book for kids. Y'all can get any of these books at Pickard's Universe at 10th and Indiana, Heritage Antique Mall at 15th and Lamar, and please shop locally if you live here, or you can order them on Amazon.com. Just type in my name and my books will pop up. Thank y'all.